Ja.
And why are there Bernie bros and not Bernie hoes?
So there are.
Did we talk about having edibles at my holiday party?
And that I always underestimated is that men really like breasts.
Do you think I'm a Karen?
Valentine's Day is like New Year's Eve with nuclear weapons.
What you just said was so slut-shaming. And I wanted to
see how it's slut-shaming. Welcome to the Femsplainers. I'm Danielle Crittenden, and welcome to what I hope is going to be a very interesting show about love, betrayal, and at least in one of our subjects' case, a fear of rejection so strong it led to a spectacular career in entertainment. So joining me for the Up Top cocktail segment of our show is Jillian Hamilton, who does a weekly podcast here, Podcast One, our network of the Femsplainers. It's called Cheating When Love Lies. Now, Jillian herself is a fascinating woman. In France, she became the first Black American female to host more than 5 national TV shows in French. She's performed on the stage in musicals and also hosted shows on this side of the Atlantic for Fox and Discovery Networks, among many others. But then Jillian got interested in cheating, why people do it, how they do it, and what it says about their relationships. Is the cheating person always in the wrong? How do you recover from a cheater? And why did Jillian get so obsessed with this subject? Was she perhaps a victim of cheating herself? I will ask her. After Jillian, I'm thrilled to welcome Kit Shapiro, the daughter of famed entertainer Eartha Kitt, onto the show. She has written a memoir called Eartha and Kitt, A Daughter's Love Story in Black and White. And it is literally that, in black and white. Kit is the only child of a Black mother and white father, and she grew up navigating between the two worlds of race, one that often penalized her mother for being Black and privileging Kit because Kit looks otherwise completely white. How Kit did this and what it taught her about stereotypes is just one of the many subjects we'll explore. But primarily, Kit's is a story about the bonds and love between mothers and daughters, and the wisdom she learned from the remarkably strong example of her famous mother, who began life as the rejected child of a sharecropper. But first, let's bring on Jillian. Jillian, welcome to the Femsplainers.
Thank you so much for having me, Danielle. It's great to be here.
Well, welcome to the fun part of the podcast, because you're up top in the cocktail. I can't call it cocktail hour, but cocktail segment.
Okay.
What is your favorite cocktail?
Oh, gosh, I love the sidecar.
Oh, a sidecar is.
I know that sounds so old fashioned, but I do like the sidecar.
It's a beautiful thing when made properly.
Oh, you have me thinking of a bartender I love not far from my home, and he makes a fabulous sidecar. I love a Cosmo. I know it's very like 80s, 90s, but I love a Cosmo as well.
I'm going to join you in a sidecar, I think.
With
that.
Yeah.
That's one of my specialties too. In the winter, I make sidecars.
Yes, but with fall here, it's perfect.
So Jillian, tell me about, you've had such an interesting career as a performer, as a news presenter and host, but now you're devoted to a podcast.
Yeah.
Actually, devoted is the wrong word for a podcast called Cheating When Love Lies. So tell me what made you decide to do a podcast entirely about cheating. And it's also fascinating how you do it. So we can talk about that too.
Oh, thank you so much for that compliment. Yes, I started writing short fictional stories about affairs. I had grown up in a family where there were affairs. I've experienced affairs in my adult life as well. And I started writing these short fictional stories about them during COVID, right? We're all at home. I'd always wanted to write. And I was very compelled by the subject matter. And once I started writing and sharing the stories with friends, they really liked them. And they said, wait a minute, I have a cheating story too. So I really learned that so many people are affected by cheating. It really is that thing that no person, no family can escape, whether it's yourself, a brother, a sister, a mother, a father, that most people have been affected by cheating. And so that also furthered my interest in writing about the topic. And I realized that it's taboo, it's rarely discussed, or there are lots of stereotypes or presumptions about affairs that people have. So it really gave me an outlet to talk about something that's not often discussed and express it in my own unique way, as I think we're going to get into.
That's right. So you now take a story, and it's usually based on something, a true story that you've heard from someone, or
correct. Yes, absolutely.
And then you write this dramatized short story, or read it, which is really great and fascinating. And then you have assembled different people to come and discuss their reaction to, and we're talking mostly about romantic cheating, right? It's not like cheating at a poker game, is it? Or do you ever?
It's all about romantic cheating, relationship cheating. Yes, okay. It's not cheating at large. It's specifically relationship cheating. And when I started writing the stories, and as I said, I heard from people talking about their own experiences with cheating, how they were affected by cheating, I decided that it would be really interesting to get diverse people's responses to the stories that had been based on true life events. So I've been really lucky because I call them round tables. It's three different people, typically from very, very diverse backgrounds, that comment on and react to the story and then share their own thoughts on infidelity. So in my very first round table, I have, you know, a very bourgeois Australian woman with, an urban, I call him a kid, he's in his 20s, from, the urban areas, and then a very sort of like conservative Midwestern guy, and they all talk about their experiences with infidelity, whether having been cheated on or having been a cheater, and they react to the story. And it's just fascinating what different perspectives you get from these diverse groups of people.
And it's not, and I think this is the fun of it, it's not like experts. It's not like you've brought in a divorce lawyer or a counselor.
No.
It's really like a kind of, as you say, different perspectives, almost gossip session, but an insightful gossip session after about what has happened in the story. Why do you call it taboo, though? Like, people aren't really afraid to discuss cheating. In what way do you find it still taboo?
Oh, I find it very taboo. I mean, I had a story where I was out to dinner and I was approached by a gentleman, and, you know, he was talking and he said, you know, what do you do? And I said, well, I've started this podcast about cheating and I don't know this gentleman from Adam. And he starts to tell me, oh, well, I'm having an affair and I want to talk to you about it. You know, so
I hope that wasn't his pickup line, honest to God.
I didn't explore it enough to find out.
It wouldn't work, I don't think. A pretty lousy pickup line.
This incredible story about how he was having an emotional affair. So this is not someone that's going to go out into the community and say, hey, you know, Joe, I had a great golf game and let me tell you about my affair. You know, it's definitely is something that's kept under the rug, under the carpet, behind the closed door. It's taboo. I mean, it's happening, but nobody's really talking about it openly. Well,
that is true. I mean, people, I always think of myself as leading a completely conventional bourgeois, as you say, life. And then I realize how sheltered I am from everything that is gone out there. So what are some of the more surprising or unconventional forms of cheating that you have come across?
Well, on my very first episode, I don't want to completely give it away, but there's a couple, they go to marriage counseling and the wife ends up having an affair with the therapist. So that's rather unusual. As I told you, lots of emotional affairs. This other gentleman that I cited before, he was sending music back and forth, you know, over the internet with an emotional lover. And although he was a very dedicated and devoted husband and father, you know, every night he would like run into the car and share these songs. And for him, it was very emotional, you know, almost more so than sleeping with her, because they felt this connection over the music and what they had shared. There are people, I have a woman who was cheated on when she was pregnant, not once, but twice, and was kind of like a de facto sex slave to her husband. He had a quota, the amount of times that she had to, you know, be intimate with him. She finally divorced this guy and then immediately ends up becoming someone else's mistress. So we explore that journey. How do you go from, you know, being cheated on to immediately becoming a mistress? So it really is a very compelling and interesting look at how people approach cheating and affairs and why.
Do you find yourself ever sympathetic to the cheaters?
I am sympathetic to people at large. It is not a judgmental show. I never want anyone to feel like they're going to be judged or, you know, disparaged for the way they behave. We don't only look at the cheating incident, we look at their lives and the context around the cheating. So, no, I really make it a point not to judge, not to disparage. I want it to be an open forum where people feel like they can talk openly, because that is the point, to inform, to educate, and to help others. You know, if I'm shutting people down, then people are not going to be so inclined to come on and speak their truth or speak openly about the experience they've had, whether they're the cheater or the betrayed partner. You know, some people might feel, quote unquote, embarrassed. I mean, I've had people say, oh, I'm embarrassed to say, and I say, don't be embarrassed. You know, maybe you were mistreated. Maybe you were in an abusive relationship, and a man or woman, right? I don't like to make assumptions that it's only men cheating, because it is not. You know, don't be embarrassed to have endured those situations or to have endured the betrayal, because this is a forum for understanding why, not for judging what you have done.
And you are you married?
Not anymore.
Okay. What was there a cheating angle involved in the end of your marriage, if I may ask?
Or is... Yes, you may ask. And I feel like there's an emotional experience that led to, it really is. I'm not even divorced yet. I always say that. People say, are you not married? I'm not divorced yet. I don't even know if I'm ever going to be divorced, because my daughter's father and I get along extraordinarily well. Mm-hmm. And we're very happy co-parenting. So it's, I guess, now I'm dating. So theoretically, yes. I mean, he's cheating, I'm cheating, because theoretically we're still married. But it had been a while that we were estranged.
So I guess you said it in your background. I'm just trying to, I guess, play lay psychiatrist and look into maybe what you personally are trying to discover or understand through these different stories as it relates to your own past.
Yes, it totally relates to relationships at large, because what I'm discovering, and again, I'm not an expert. I like to say to people, I'm a big sister. I ask questions. I hope I ask the right questions, but I don't have any answers. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a therapist. I'm not going to give anyone advice. I can share my point of view, but I don't give out advice. What I'm learning is that, you know, cheating is the symptom of a greater relationship problem, right? The show doesn't cover hookups. I'm not talking about people, oh, I went up to a bar, I got drunk and I slept with him. That I don't cover hookups. I cover, you know, relationships. So the cheating is a symptom of what? So very much so, the podcast ends up talking about the context and nature of different relationships and how they get to that point where it manifests through infidelity.
And have you come across any common themes, such as of why people cheat, and men and women both? And yes. Do they cheat? Do you notice any differences in the way that men and women cheat or why they cheat, if one can make those generalizations?
Yes, I will agree with you that they are generalizations. So this is a generalization, but typically men cheat to stay and women cheat to leave.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. The man, typically, in general, the man is thinking, if I can just keep my foundation at home, you know, fulfill my role as husband and father, I just need this something on the outside, which will allow me to continue in my role as husband and father. Whereas women are thinking, I got to get out of this situation. I want to get out of here. And this man could be my ticket out. Whether I necessarily marry him or don't, doesn't matter. But it gives me the strength and the fortitude to leave, because I know that I have emotional support waiting on the other side of the door.
That's so interesting. And actually, one of your most recent one that I listened to was about a seemingly happily married man who, very wealthy, you know, East Hampton kind of modern Mad Men, Betty Draper kind of life.
And he
ends up cheating, but she, I guess the question is, will you, you know, can she forgive him? Should she forgive him?
Yes.
And in that case, it seemed very typical and goes to what you say about men go, I mean, is what they're going outside of the house in a situation like this where otherwise they're seemingly content. Is it about sex? I mean, basically that they want, they want sex that they're not getting at home, but from probably a very tired wife or, you know, household filled with kids.
Right.
Is that sort of the theme? And that, as you say, then I don't want to stay. And that's why it doesn't mean a lot. I mean, I want to stay, sorry. Mm-hmm. That's why this didn't mean anything. It was just the sex part, like that men can think differently, think of relationships in these parts in the way that women can't.
Well,
fair?
Again, I do want to stress that cheating when love lies is about affairs, not about hookups.
Yes.
So I think that you're going, you know, exclusively or predominantly for the sex in a hookup. But when you're talking about a relationship, when you have a mistress or a lover, someone that you're taking time away from your family to be with, that you have a secret relationship, that you're risking being caught by talking to them on the phone or sending texts with them, these, you're putting at risk, you know, what we call your foundation, which is your family, your husband, or your wife. So it's not going to be about the sex per se. It's about what the sex represents. I feel validated. I feel affirmed. I feel wanted. I'm made to feel appreciated. I'm made to feel pretty. I'm made to feel handsome. I'm made to feel sexy. So it's not only the sex. It's what the sex represents.
Right. Okay. And you think, I mean, it's interesting because I would take a very hard line against a husband who cheated, as I think my husband knows, he's often commented on my right hook, but, you know, that's not everybody's view. And I, you know, taking the sympathetic view of what causes people to cheat, I think is fascinating.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't know each other well, so I can't speak for you. But oftentimes when people come on to Cheating When Love Lies, they'll say, you know, I, particularly the women, if he ever did this, he's out. And I say, well, do you have children? How old are your children? Are you self-sufficient? Is everyone healthy? You know, what are the barriers to leaving for both men or women? And actually, I think it's episode 3, the interviews with a man that we call Clark, you know, I change people's names and what have you. And he talks very openly, you know, he's having an affair with 7 or 8 different women, more or less simultaneously in his community. He's married and they're all married. And I was like, you haven't found someone that you want to leave and set up shop with elsewhere? And he said, no, I can't leave. I have too many responsibilities. I have a foundation to maintain. I have financial obligations. You know, that seemed to be his predominant reason for not leaving. I can't go. I can't do it.
Right. And that's often true, especially for the woman who,
yes,
and in this most recent one that I listened to, has built her whole life based,
yes,
on this perfectionist, in some ways, what turns out to be a lie. Yeah. I mean, you do have to weigh, obviously, everything that you've built. And if you have, as a woman, given up your opportunity to work or taken time out for your children, it's very hard to go back, and thus very hard to,
yes,
just blow all of that up. But it also leaves you in a absolutely terrible, I think, situation of, you know, broken trust.
Right. It can be. But in the story that you listened to, you know, the wife forgave him. Right. She was able to forgive, perhaps forget, and move on. People do rebuild their relationships after affairs. They can even become stronger. I haven't had an interview yet, and I'd love to get a good interview where someone says, wow, we're stronger now than we ever were. But it does happen.
Yeah, I think of the punchline of a Jewish joke to this, which is, I'll forget Sheldon and you'll forget Sheldon, but I won't forget it, Sheldon. And don't you forget it, Sheldon. I think that's maybe the attitude.
Right, exactly.
But anyway, Jillian, thank you for joining me. It's a great show. The podcast is called Cheating When Love Lies. It's, of course, here on Podcast One. You will find it. And Jillian, good luck with that.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me, Danielle.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Cheers.
Bye.
Hot flashes, irritability, intimate dryness, and maybe even unsatisfying sex. My femsplainers, does any of this sound familiar? If so, you're not alone. Bonafide is a women's health company dedicated to providing women with safe, non-hormonal, and clinically validated products that work. Bonafide offers an alternative to effectively relieve the symptoms that accompany hormonal fluctuations within their body, because every woman deserves relief without compromise. Bonafide provides safe and effective solutions to manage a range of menopausal, sexual health, and PMS-related symptoms. Bonafide offers women naturally powerful remedies to safely treat the natural symptoms that occur throughout their lives, from PMS to menopause and everything else along the way. As a woman, what I like most is that Bonafide products provide women real relief without compromise. So don't waste another minute feeling less than your best. Give Bonafide a try today. No prescription is required. Go to hellobonafide.com. That's hello, B-O-N-A-F-I-D-E. Go to hellobonafide.com and use code FEMSPLAIN to save 20%. That's hellobonafide.com and use code FEMSPLAIN to save 20%.
Well, I don't know how to think about all different types of cheating, but part of discussing it, I think the fun is being a little judgmental, don't you think? So when I listen to the Cheating When Love Lies podcast, I'm filled with all kinds of judgments. But anyway, moving on. Just a reminder, if you're liking these conversations, to please like us on iTunes, give us 5 stars where you can, give a positive comment, and also please consider supporting the podcast on Patreon. This is how we survive. This is how we make ends meet here. Going to patreon.com/femsplainers, pledging whatever you can. And in return, you do get benefits. You get a monthly podcast in which you get to ask our guests questions. You get our monthly newsletter. And at certain levels, you'll get this podcast early and ad free. So again, go to patreon.com/femsplainers and please buy us a drink. Okay, now let me bring on Kit Shapiro. Again, she is the author of Eartha and Kit, A Daughter's Love Story in Black and White.
We talk sex, lies, murder.
When two is company, three is murder.
This is the epitome of it right here.
How does your life go from being a housewife to participating in a murder?
The pastor of the church having sex with another woman.
This is beyond dysfunctional.
Sex, Lies, and Murder. A Real Crime original podcast from Reels. New episodes Wednesdays on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, and Spotify.
Kit, welcome to the Femsplainers.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
As I was reading your book, I was thinking, this is like the very opposite of a Mommy Dearest memoir. Like, I keep waiting for the, you know, big reveal of what a monster your mother was. Like, nothing like that. Nothing like that.
No, definitely. She was nothing like that. I mean, what can I say? You know, I mean, I was truly blessed. I'd say that to people. And I don't want people to get the wrong impression. It's not as if, you know, this was not Nirvana. I mean, we were typical mother-daughter. And, you know, there were many times when I would roll my eyes and you know, we'd be driving down the street and I was a teenager or a young adult. And, you know, I would wish that the door on her side of the car would just open and she would roll out. I mean, it was like, you know, there were typical mother-daughter moments. But that's not what this book is. And that's not what the story is. The story really is about these two people who happened to be mother and daughter, and it truly was a love story. And we were so very blessed to have understood the importance that we had for each other during our lives together. And I think that was really important. That was the piece that, you know, it's this person that I wanted people to know, to get to know, this human being that my mother was, this parent that she was, this loving doting mother, because it's a piece that you didn't really get to see, you know, that much of, because of the persona that she had of, you know, this femme fatale and you know, this gorgeous, I mean, she was beautiful at all times, but, you know, this very dramatic and over the top sort of celebrity. And so she was much, you know, she was really a simple, loving, caring mother. And I think that that's the heartwarming, I think, piece of the story that the people I wanted to share with people.
Well, there are many paradoxes between what you write about her as your mother and then, as you say, her persona. But before we get to those, she died in 2008. So mm-hmm. Why now? What made you want to write this memoir?
I mean, I think, you know, there's a piece I've written that in a that I talk about. It says a person who is born twice, you know, once at birth and then again when their mother dies. And I think there's a separation that happens when you lose a mother, especially when you lose a parent, but especially I think especially the relationship my mother and I had, that, you know, when you lose a mother, there's an adjustment period. You're no longer somebody's child. You're no longer you know, the daughter to a mother. I think that's not an easy, wasn't an easy piece for me at all, as I talk about in the book. And then, you know, as you evolve as an adult and life goes on and you see what's going on around you. And I've certainly, as I've gotten older, I've gained an increased sense of appreciation for the human being that my mother was. And then I believe, you know, with social media and where the world has been and where people would continue to talk about my genetic makeup, and people have doubted that I am my mother's biological child because of the way that I look. And there is, for a long time, I would just, you know, sort of like not pay any attention to them, not even respond to those trolls on social media who would say, you know, your mother clearly lied to you and you were obviously adopted because you couldn't possibly be her biological child. You couldn't look the way that you look if she gave birth to you. So I think I got to a point where it's like, you know what, we need to talk about this. We really need to sort of address this elephant in the room and this issue that people have with, you know, this desire that they need to you to look a certain way because that's how they have predetermined you should look. And if you don't look that way, then you can't possibly be who you say you are. And I find this, and my mother struggled with, obviously, this need to pigeonhole and to categorize people and to make them be specific. You know, you had to be fit into this little box, or if you don't fit into the box, then you're not meant to be in the box. So I think it was, the time was just, you know, right, where we're talking constantly now in social media about, you know, race and treatment of people and be kind to one another and accepting of who we are, accepting of ourselves, accepting of each other, accepting of your neighbor, treating your neighbor with kindness, understanding that we're all different. And that's the beauty of human beings. So it just, the timing was just, you know, just happened to, as my mother always said, everything happens when it's supposed to. God may not be there when you want him, but he's always on time. And you have to really trust that. And it was just, it just seemed like, you know, the moment was right. And here we are talking about the book.
Well, one of the things that I was very apparent was that your mother fit into no box of any kind. And so let's start a little bit about reminding people of her background, where and how she was born and growing up during, she's born in 1927. So this is not a good time for, you know, Black performers, Black entertainers, but that wasn't even her aspiration. So let's tell us, start at the beginning.
So she was born in a small little town in South Carolina called North South Carolina. It's in Columbia County, Orangeburg, South Carolina, near there. She was born on a cotton plantation. To her families were shareholders, sharecroppers. And she didn't know who her mother, her father was. She never knew his identity up until she died. She never found out his identity. Her mother was a Black woman and possibly mixed race, but of Cherokee and Black. My mother, it was assumed that her biological father was white. But as I said, since she never learned his identity, she never knew that. But her mother gave her away at a very young age because my mother's skin tone wasn't dark enough for the area, for the people that they were, you know, so were surrounded by, the families that they lived with. And they called my mother a yellow gal because of that, which was, you know, a term used when you know, for a person who doesn't fit in, they're not Black enough, and she certainly wasn't white enough to fit into the, you know, a white community. So she sort of was born this misfit. And that was what she learned early on, how badly she was treated by the community that she grew up in, and then obviously later by society, that you, how do you treat, she ever understood how you can mistreat a child, an infant, because of something that is completely and totally out of their control, the color of their skin. And that was such a part of her. It was so ingrained in this, the inhumanness of the treatment that she withstood in the South, that I think she became outspoken and stood up for other people who were also misfits and didn't fit the, you know, the box of whatever checked box that they, you know, people thought they should go into. She always stood up for them because she didn't understand why there was that need to make people.
Well, and she got it from both sides. There was, I guess, some speculation. Yeah. But as you say, she never found out, so you won't know that. We won't know that she was the product of a rape of the son of the family whom her mother worked for. But she was one of the reasons she was given away, I think at age 5, maybe.
Yeah, she was never exactly sure her age, but yeah, it was very young, very young.
Sent to an aunt. Did she go directly to New York City? Was she sent to?
No. So first, her mother gave her away because her mother went to marry a man, a Black man, and he said to her, "I'll take my." There was a half sister. My mother had a half sister. He said, "I'll take Pearl, but I won't take Eartha Mae. I won't have that yellow gal living in my house." So her mother had to give her away, and the family that took her in the South was horrible towards her. I mean, my mother said, you know, Cinderella was treated far better than my mother ever was. You know,
They were not relatives.
They sexually, they emotionally abused her. I mean, they beat her. You know, she would tell me the young kids, even the teenagers of this family, would tie my mother to a tree, and they would pull down her pants and they would beat her with sugar cane, which if you peel back the strips of sugar cane, it's very sharp. Sugar cane stalks are very sharp underneath. And so they would beat her with these sugar cane stalks, and they, you know, they sexually abused her and they would taunt her. And so, you know, this was the life that she lived as a tiny child. And it wasn't until she was probably maybe 8 or 9 years old that word had gone to an aunt in New York City, and people had said to her, if you don't get this child out of here, they're going to kill her. And so this aunt in New York City sent for my mother, and that's when they put my mother on the train, which she'd never seen You know, she'd seen the train go by, but she'd never been on the train. And then when she came to New York City, that was a whole new world, that literally, that she discovered when she went to live with her aunt.
And her aunt turned out to be no magical fairy godmother like aunt, that she was pretty tough, but maybe not compared to what she was used to, had been used to.
Yeah, I mean, the aunt was not exactly motherly, but she felt an obligation to save this child. And my mother wondered, as my mother got older, she often questioned, she started to wonder if the aunt was actually her biological mother, because, you know, it was, she didn't treat her like she, you know, like she was loving, but she had this obligation that she, you know, to get her out of the South. So there was a reason she felt that, you know, underlying more than just, you know, it was her niece. But yeah, like you said, she wasn't, you know, she was harsh. She was a harsh woman with no maternal instincts or skills. But she gave my mother a roof and food and, you know, clothing and schooling. So my mother was always grateful to her for that.
Well, and then her talent was just recognized early on. I mean, she was very young, and it was a teacher, right, who recognized her talent. And she just seemed to go so quickly from there.
You know, my mother always spoke of, there were two teachers. There was one in the South that talked to her very early on, but my mother remembered her saying, you put her hand on her shoulder and she said, you have the hand of God on you and never forget that. And then there was a teacher in New York, in public school, who helped my mother find her voice, literally find her voice, because she was terrified. She was so shy. She didn't speak in public. She didn't want to speak in class. She didn't want to speak anywhere. She was afraid. She was afraid of what might happen to her. So someone might beat her, or, you know, abuse her somehow. So this teacher really tried to pull that piece out of her. She saw something in her. And to the day she died, you know, she spoke about how the impact of this teacher had on her. And she had such an appreciation for teachers and the power that they wield. So this teacher gave her a poem to read and to recite, and helped her, you know, get the courage to stand up in front of a class and recite, stanzas from poems or from some plays. And then the teacher gave her tickets to go see a Broadway show. And it was really that she went to see Cyrano de Bergerac on Broadway. That was really that what my mother saw and felt in that theater was how I think she was transported to that place that gave her that desire to become, an entertainer.
Well, as you wrote, it wasn't just, you know, the magical make-believe world of Broadway. It was also, she was very struck by the adulation that the actors, the lead actor received, the standing ovation, that it was, here is acceptance on a mass scale that I did not experience and have not experienced as a child.
Right. That feeling that an audience, you know, gives, gave to that performer, was, my mother was astounded by it. It just, you know, she felt that was incredible love and this incredible amount of attention that was focused on one person because of the performance and the way that what they delivered to the audience felt. So there was this relationship that she saw that transpired between a performer and an audience. And that gave her this yearning to feel that same way, to be given that same adulation, to be given, you know, that acceptance. So she'd never been accepted for being who she was. So she felt that would be a way to achieve that.
And was she musical up to that point? Like, had she been singing? Did you know, was this something that the teacher saw as well, that she had a beautiful voice? Or
no, I don't think she was necessarily musical in the classroom or in school. But, you know, my mother taught me in the South, they would often, you know, sing in the cotton fields. She sang in church, in the Baptist church in the South. And then when she moved to New York, her aunt lived in Spanish Harlem. And my mother would talk about how there were always drums and there was music playing. And, you know, there was always this beat that she said you felt. And she started, you know, she learned to move and watch people dancing in the streets, literally, you know, because that's what people, you know, she said, when you're poor, that's what you do. You listen to the music and to entertain yourselves, you start dancing with each other. And she loved the Afro beat and the Latin beats, because that's what surrounded her in the streets of New York City. And that's how she just learned how to go with that and listen to it, you know, and it internalized it. And then she did get a scholarship to the New York School of Performing Arts. And, you know, that's when her dance became more, you know, trained, and her voice started, you know, she started focusing on her voice and voice training. And learned that the importance of really becoming multidimensional in theater and the entertainment business, the importance of learning every aspect. You don't just learn dance. She didn't want to just learn one thing, dance or voice, but she wanted to learn it all: how to apply makeup, how to sew, how to do, you know, scenes, how to write, how to direct. I mean, she wanted to be all encompassed in that world of creativity.
And then she develops also fairly quickly on. I mean, she's so beautiful and she's got this sexy voice. And her early songs are sort of classic 1940s, you know, jazz. And she's so seductive. And yet she marries an accountant that she didn't seem to have. I want to get into this a little more after this. But she then was the very opposite in her private life from this stage persona as literally a sex kitten. So tell me a little bit about your father and how you came into this world with Eartha Kitt as your mom.
I think that it often happens where, you know, you're pushed, forced, you know, you enter the scene of celebrity status and fame. And it's, you know, it can be intimidating, right? I mean, my mother was a very petite person also. So when she would be, you know, go in public or be, you know, be seen, you know, the paparazzi wasn't like it is today. We didn't have cell phones, but people were, you know, accosted, you know, by fans. And my mother was very much, you know, she was internationally famous. And I think on some level, it's sort of that, you know, you want that life, but you also want to come home and have a quieter life. You yearn for some sense of, you know, more of normalcy. And she never really had a sense of normalcy. I mean, her normalcy in the you know, early on was being, you know, abused and treated horribly. And then, you know, her evolution to becoming, you know, an entertainer happened very quickly as a teenager and young adult. And then she was thrust onto the world stage of fame. So I think that, you know, she ended up with my father after being very disappointed by, you know, in numerous relationships with very powerful men. Who happened to also, who were white, yes. And in two instances, their mothers would not allow their relationships to, you know, with my mother, because obviously at that time, you know, interracial marriage was not acceptable. And when you're marrying somebody who might have, you know, a very powerful family, they didn't want to, you know, have their name, you know, taken down by marrying someone of color. I mean, that was the reality, unfortunately. And so my mother had a tough time with her relationships and never seemed in her mind to pick the right person. So when my father stumbled into her life, he was this kind of regular, normal, you know, not famous guy. She thought, okay, that's probably a good fit for me. I think, you know, I think she was being very logical about, you know, I'll settle down with somebody who's not in the entertainment business, and it'll be, you know, then I won't get hurt. Then I'll be safe. Didn't turn out quite that way, but that's what she'd hoped for.
Well, and also I think the big bonus too was your grandmother, her mother-in-law loved her. That
yes.
Completely embraced.
Yeah.
This remarkable daughter-in-law.
Yes, my grandmother, my father's mother, absolutely adored my mother. Loved that she, my father's mother was the matriarch of this family, and she was a very strong and powerful woman herself. And she loved the fact that my mother was such an independent and strong, strong-willed woman. And that they were very, simpatico, as my mother would say. And so my mother really adored her mother-in-law.
But once she had you, that was it. You were her family, as you write mm-hmm. about, that she took you everywhere. The marriage only lasted a couple, like maybe 3 years after you were born or so. Mm-hmm. She was traveling a lot, I guess. But she said she got married because she wanted a baby. And then when she had you, that was it. It was like, that's all the family I need.
Yeah, something definitely a switch was flipped when my mother had me. There was this, I think I gave her this foundation that she had so yearned for, this connection to another human being that she had so yearned for her entire life. And she would often introduce us and she would say, I'm Eartha and this is Kit, as if I completed her somehow. And I think in many ways I really did. I don't know, if she really, I think as she got older, she looked back on her marriage and she reflected differently on it. I do think that my parents did have a very close relationship at some point. I think there was true love there at some point. Unfortunately, it's not how my mother talked about her marriage as she got older. But that being said, my mother absolutely adored, being a mother. She loved having this little creature that she had created, been part of creating and brought into this world. She loved the fact that I, didn't look like anything that was expected. She used to say to me, you're like a walking United Nations. You either fill every quota or you break every rule. And I think she really, it took joy in that she could, I was sort of this little mutt that was, I think that's, she loved going against the trends. And I think that I was another part of that. And so, the marriage fell apart, but she became, incredibly devoted and just totally all in as a parent. And so whenever she would perform and travel internationally, because she was internationally known, she felt it was really important to have me with her at all times because she didn't want to leave me behind. She didn't want someone else to raise me. So I was, she'd take me on the road. She would say, I put my baby on one hip and the diaper bag on the other and off we would go. And that is pretty much how my early years were spent.
Right. Well, and as you wrote, she suffered from terrible stage fright. She had this fear of rejection, which is, totally understandable. But she never remarried. It was like she never trusted men again. She famously was quoted, a man, if she would ever make a compromise for the right man. And she said, why? A man comes into my life and I have to compromise. And you did not have a great reaction to that. But because in the end, you had this remarkable childhood, but it was intense. It was like an intense affair between you and your mother. And there was never anyone else. There was no other man, boyfriend, stepfather, buffer.
Right. No, I mean, she dated a few people, but yeah, there was never a buffer. And that I felt as an only child was heavy. It's very heavy. It's a lot of responsibility. I carried not only her name, but I carried this onus of, like I am all she had. And that's not an easy, it's not easy. There were times definitely as a teenager and as a young adult. And, then it was, I just felt like, this isn't the way it's supposed to be. There's supposed to be another person. There's supposed to be someone that, she can, go to and say, that child's making me crazy or, and she's have to, she's her own person. She needs to focus on other things, not just me. So, there were some, there were some struggles internally that I had. There were struggles that the two of us had between each other, which I think is very normal with a single parent, especially with, a mother with a daughter.
Right. And you said that you never rebelled. You never did drugs. I mean, she was a strict, she was a loving mother, but a strict mother.
She's very strict and very much a disciplinarian. As I said, very affectionate, very loving, but never hit me and never was abusive, but boy, did I know my place. I mean, you didn't talk back. You didn't, weren't disrespectful. I think that was a part of me that I understood. I often say I was born like a really good fit. I just somehow knew I was a good fit for this person. And I remember as a little tiny girl saying to her, God picked me to be your daughter. And he knew that I was going to be the right person for you. And I understood that somehow. And that was okay with me. I think that, even though there was times and as I struggled with being, so was the center of her world, there was also a part of me that understood that, there's a piece of me that felt that my role was to be who I was to her. For the most part, it worked really well for us.
Well, and she was the other thing that I took away from this. So you have this paradox of her being the sex kitten, but doesn't want anything to do with men in many ways, if she doesn't want to trust them or depend mm-hmm. on one. She's also incredibly hardworking, and she's entertaining through the 50s, 60s, early 70s. It becomes the era of the, the Brat Pack. People smoke. There's a lot of alcohol and drugs. And given she's a single mother, and given what she came from and went through, it would have been understandable if she'd kind of fallen into that world as well, but she did not.
And she protected me from that world also. I think that was, important for her to, again, I was the reason I think she so, was so much, in many ways, she was a recluse. I mean, she really was, her world, she would go perform. She did her, her career was really important. And that was the persona she put out there of this sex kitten and this come hither. Although she never really crossed the line, those days you were still very conservative. Everything was covered up and, you saw a leg and you saw, you didn't really see, it wasn't blatantly, sexual. But she would then come home and that's where she wanted to be. She wanted to be in her garden with her vegetables, with her animals, and home with her child. And she was very clear about that. I also, my mother was a hard worker because she understood that that's, you don't stop. You do as I mentioned earlier, you learn every part, you learn every role. You can step in when somebody else maybe not able to, to do the job. And that way you're always needed. I think that was important for her to always be a necessary piece in the puzzle. She also, understood that hard work was what you did. I think that was part of her generation. I think it was part of where she grew up, in the South. I mean, she would explain to me picking cotton is really hard work. Picking a pound of cotton takes a lot of literally back-breaking time and effort. And she said, that's what you do. If you want to just keep in the game, you just keep, one foot in front of the other in life, keep plowing through it, literally.
Ritual is the multivitamin company you know and trust, not least because it was created by a woman, Katarina Schneider, who wouldn't settle for less than the truth. She founded Ritual with the belief that better health begins with better ingredients, with no unnecessary ingredients, and with nutrients in their best forms. Ritual has done clinical studies and works in collaboration with an advisory board of medical doctors, nutritionists, and scientists. Well, now Ritual has launched a line of protein powders. Protein powders can feel intimidating in the no pain, no gain way, and their formula is opaque, not just because they're a powder, but the truth is, deep down, as in cellular level deep, we all need protein, and it's about more than just muscles. So Ritual's team of scientists reimagine protein from the ground up and inside out, from how it's made to who it's for and why it's needed. The result is a delicious plant-based protein offered in three premium formulations for distinct life stages and unique nutrient needs, all made with the same high standards approach and commitment to traceability that Ritual is known for. So whether you're doing reps or just more into dog walks, essential protein is here to shake things up. And I know as a woman in my 50s who works out regularly, I've often wondered about taking a protein supplement, but I haven't understood fully why I should or what form of it would be best for me. And I think that's what I love most about Ritual products. Ritual's protein is made with nutrients to support bones, brains, and muscles and help maintain muscle mass as we age. Its clean, plant-based formulas are specifically created to support nutrient needs of different life stages, 18 plus, pregnancy and postpartum, 50 plus, and offers 20 grams of pea, that's as in PEA, protein, plus a complete amino acid profile. And it's designed to help fill commentary dietary gaps. And maybe best of all, it's a protein powder with good taste. Its delicious handcrafted vanilla flavor is made from a direct from farmer vanilla bean extract sustainably harvested in Madagascar. And there are no added sugar or sugar alcohols. And like all Ritual products, essential protein is soy-free, gluten-free, and formulated with non-GMO ingredients. So why not shake up your Ritual? To make trying something new less scary, Ritual offers a money-back guarantee if you're not 100% in love with their new protein powders. Plus, my listeners get 10% off during your first 3 months. Just visit ritual.com/femsplain to add essential protein today. That's ritual.com/femsplain, and you'll get 10% off during your first 3 months.
What did you think as a child when you'd see your mom, and as mom, as you say, she liked to put on her sweat clothes, be in the garden, early adopter, by the way, of non-processed foods.
Yeah.
She's like a original farm-to-table lady. But and then you'd see her, I guess, in her dressing room, and she would put on the furs and the hair and the wigs and the makeup and the slinky dresses. And you'd watch your mother transform in front of you and then go out on the stage. And I assume behave nothing like you were used to seeing your mother behave. What,
right.
What did you think? What went through your mind when this happened?
You know, I'm not really 100% sure. I mean, by the time I was born, my mother was already very famous. So I didn't see any different, you know, I didn't see any other life. I saw her at home, like you said, in the vegetable garden, picking the vegetables with her hands in the dirt and recycling, repurposing. And she understood from when I was before I was born, the importance of the environment and taking care of our soil and taking care of our world around us and eating healthy and farm to table, as you mentioned, was the utmost importance to her. And then, you know, she would become this other character and put on these clothes and go onto the stage. To me, it was like, well, that's what, you know, what my mother does, I guess. I don't know. I mean, it just seemed like, like a normal.
Well, some people's dads are firemen and they put on their fires.
They put on a costume, right? Think of that. Everybody puts on a uniform of some hat. My mother's uniform just happened to be, you know, this glamorous person that's standing up on the stage, being, you know, idolized by fans. So I don't really think I understood the impact that she had on the world until, you know, I was much older, the impact on socially, politically, you know, she was really a trailblazer on so many different levels. And, you know, and she was an independent, you know, single mother who was, you know, who went to work and took care of her family and spoke out and was always true to herself, didn't compromise who she was for anybody else or anything else, and stood up for others who didn't have a voice, maybe, and stood up for injustice. So, you know, this incredibly strong woman is role model that I have that I, you know, I took for granted a lot of, you know, a lot of the early years, and then you become, you know, what she expected of me was that she also expected to, you know, a trailblazer in some ways, maybe not on the same, international level that she was at, but, you know, someone who stood up for what was right and treated people with kindness and, you know, spoke out against what they saw, you know, an injustice that maybe I saw, you know, whether someone was being treated, not fairly in my class or in my neighborhood. You know, she expected me to be a strong woman.
Well, let's talk about some of the incidents. I mean, you wrote that you never really saw her experience sort of overt racism. Now, obviously she did, and you were kids, so some of it might have flown over you, but you did have a very distinct memory of what happened in that South African amusement park and right. how your mother handled it. And it was so impressive. Can you tell that story?
So as I mentioned, and as you just alluded to, I mean, my mother, obviously a woman of color, was treated, you know, I mean, racism was everywhere. That being said, you know, we lived in Beverly Hills, California, and she was a very famous person. And I think most people are more impressed by fame than they are worried about, you know, the color of somebody's skin in that moment. So I often say to people, if, you know, I don't care how prejudiced you are, if, you know, Beyonce walks into the room, you're going to be, you know, starstruck. So my mother was, you know, sort of that was that level. And it really wasn't until we went to South Africa. My mother chose to go to perform in South Africa during apartheid, and many other performers chose not to do that at the time. They boycotted it because of apartheid. My mother went because she felt that artists were the true diplomats, that they didn't have to abide by political correctness, and that they could affect change just by their mere presence. My mother also understood that it takes one person to affect change. It doesn't necessarily have to be a huge movement. One person can affect the change in another person's life, and then the ripple effect happens. And that is an important way to live. So when we went to South Africa in 1973, my mother insisted on performing for interracial audiences, which was something that wasn't done there. She also wanted to raise money for African children for schools, which we did. So there was one. So my mother had a VIP status because she was a celebrity and she was American, and so she didn't have to abide by the rules of, you know, as if you had been a South African, where, you know, it was whites only in a particular establishment. I, because of the way that I look, people didn't necessarily question when I would walk into. For instance, an opera house or the amusement park that you're talking about this one particular story. We traveled with a tutor because obviously my schooling was really important. And this one instance in this town called in Durban, South Africa, we were at this hotel, which is across the street from an amusement park. And I had gone with my tutor on various occasions to bumper cars. And yeah, I mean, I was a regular kid. I was 11, 12 years old. And I really wanted my mother to go with me to this amusement park. So I kept asking her, and she was very busy. She had a very busy schedule. One day she said, okay, let's go. I have the day off. Let's go to the amusement park. And we went in, and I was so excited. And we sat down in the bumper cars, and this gentleman who worked there came up to my mother and said, excuse me, are you European? And my mother said, no, I'm American. He said, no, I don't think you understand what I'm asking. Are you colored? And she looked at her skin, and she said, well, I guess if you take this as being colored, then yeah, I guess I'm colored. And he said, well, I'm afraid, you know, this is a whites only park, and you're not allowed to be here. So you're going to have to leave. So with that, my mother got up very quietly and calmly and took my hand and started to exit the park. I, as a typical child, I think, you know, said to her very loudly and crying, you know, tell him who you are. Tell him, you know, you're a VIP. He doesn't understand. You know, explain to him you're allowed to be in the park. Just tell him. And she looked at me and she said the statement that I said earlier, you know, don't panic. You know, God may not be there when you want him, but he's always on time. And just be patient. And I didn't understand that. I didn't understand why she wasn't making a scene and making it, you know, so that she could stay. So we left, me kicking and screaming and crying hysterically, and she being very, very calm. A few days later, there was a photo shoot that my mother had for the local press, and they asked her to please position herself on this balcony. They wanted to get the picture of the amusement park in the background. And she said, oh, it's so funny. I was just thrown out of that amusement park the other day. And they said, what? What do you mean you were thrown out of the amusement park? And she told them what happened. And of course, then it was, you know, a big deal that the press, you know, publicized that she had been thrown out of this amusement park, and it was embarrassing for the owner of the amusement park. And he had, you know, he came and he called and he said, I'm so sorry. The gentleman who works there, he didn't know who you were. I, you know, my apologies. What can I do to make it up to you? So my mother said to him, well, we're raising money for the, you know, for these schools. We, you know, a donation for, you know, raise money, you know, for the African children for their schooling would be really wonderful. And, you know, my daughter would love to come back to the amusement park with some friends. So he wrote a check and, you know, sent it to for a donation that for the charity that we were raising money for. And he gave us tickets to come back to the amusement park. And of course, when we went back to the amusement park, my mother brought several children of mixed race, you know, two Black children, a few colored children, some Indian children, myself. And it's interesting when you look, there is a picture in the book of us all, you know, on this, on whatever ride we were on, and that image. So on some level, my mother knew, I don't know if she knew, she was sure that she would be able to make a statement like that, you know, in the moment when she was asked to leave the park, but she understood that somehow she could have an impact long-term, bigger than that if she had just made that scene in the moment when said, you know, I'm allowed to be here, don't you know who I am scene. And I, and it struck me, you know, for my entire life, how hard that must have been for her to, that sense of calm, to sort of swallow that treatment, to feel that somehow I'm going to be able to make this, you know, a change, to affect change, even though I'm being, you know, persecuted in this moment and being treated unnecessarily and unfairly. You know, that was a strength my mother had of being able to bite her tongue and sit with it, you know, take a beat before you react. I've always been much more of a reactionary than someone who could just sort of say, well, let me see, you know, let me see. Give me a minute. Let me think this one through. Let me take some deep breaths and think things through before I speak or act. My mother had incredible internal strength, and I don't think it came from being fearless. I think many times she was terrified, but I think she understood that if you can take a beat and you come from, you respond with from a place of strength, as opposed to a place of weakness, that you're going to, you know, there's something good could possibly come out of this.
Well, it's also a different reaction than what would happen today in many ways. That, as you say, the cell phone would have captured that whole experience and gone viral. But I don't know if a viral video would have done as much as getting the donation, taking children back into the amusement park. In a way, the amusement park owner was allowed to make amends of some kind to her, although that doesn't mean that, you know, Black or colored people, as they were called there, could ever go back into the amusement park. It wasn't like they suddenly opened it all up.
Right. It wasn't like the, you know, obviously the laws didn't change because of that. But my mother felt that the impact that she had by putting a visual, right, of being able to change something, maybe you changed it in someone else's head, right? You changed, I don't know, she was really very good at understanding that if change takes a long time, it's harder to affect, you know, really make something change quickly. And especially when it's something is, you know, is ingrained and or it's a law, obviously, or if it's ingrained, you know, from historically, she would say to me, you take a big rock and you plop it into the pond. That she said, you see how the ripples, there's big ripples, and those ripples will start to affect change on the shoreline. And the bigger the ripple, the more change that is affected. But the little pebbles, you know, they too affect change. It takes them longer and you need more of them. But over time, you will be able to make a change on the shoreline. And I think when you look at something, it's very simplistic maybe, but yet that's so true. You know, we talk about viral and cell phones right now. But you're right. I mean, I don't know if a video, a viral video, would have the same change. You still see the need. I mean, I think George, you know, the case with George Floyd, you still see the need of enough people being willing to step up and to say this, you know, and to speak out. That's really where the change happens. And I think my mother really understood that, that it's us as human beings, gathering, you know, together and building enough strength within ourselves to say something that when you are, that's how you really are able to make something change long term.
Well, let's go just to this aspect of race. You've alluded a couple times to how you look compared to your mother, and we're on a podcast. There'll be a video of you on our social channels so you can see for yourself. But you are, you know, you are and were a blonde, blue-eyed little girl. Mm-hmm. Did you ever experience any cognitive dissonance between your appearance and your mother's, and maybe vice versa?
I mean, again, I was born, my mother was already famous in the United States. You know, that sort of, that has a lot of weight. Fame carries a lot of power. I mean, I as I mentioned to you, I hear from people, you know, on social media nowadays, you know, sort of saying to me that, you know, you think you're white because, you know, and I have white privilege. I can't argue with the way how I'm treated because of the way that I look. Absolutely. I can't put myself in my mother's footsteps. I cannot put myself in anybody else's footsteps but my own. So that's, I totally understand that. I was raised by a woman who believed that was the least important thing. The reason why we should be treating each other differently was because of the color of one's skin. She felt that as human beings, that the beauty of humans is that we're all so different and we're made up so differently. We're so complex, as lily white as some people want to think they are, or as purebred as other people want to think they are. We're all mixed to some extent. It's just the nature of humans, and that, you know, we should probably all take DNA tests from at birth and kind of get past that, you know, that one thing. But I was also raised by a woman who understood the importance of learning about each other and accepting and appreciating what we all bring to the table as different people. So when we would travel, my mother really made it a point to learn about the places that we were and the people, you know, the societies that we were visiting. And she would befriend taxi drivers and, you know, local merchants and hotel staff and ask them, you know, what they believe in, what their customs were, you know, what their rituals were, where do they shop, what's the local marketplace. And she would take me with her and make sure that I really understood that the world that I grew up in Beverly Hills, California, was far from reality. That was not the real world. That was not how real people every day around the globe function. And she taught me to learn about each other, you know, to really learn what different religions, why different religions, why different customs, why different beliefs. Because she felt that when you learn and understand, then you have an appreciation. It's not about accepting it and taking it on as your own. It's about appreciating that somebody else feels equally as passionate about what their, you know, rituals and traditions are as you do about yours. And that's to respect that, those differences, and respect each other. And when you can respect each other, then, you know, and you live in some form of harmony, right? I'm allowed to exist as much as you're allowed to exist. Our differences are beautiful. It's wonderful. When I was a tiny little girl, we used to sit in the vegetable garden. My mother would pick her vegetables and I would sit there and play whatever it was I was playing, you know, in the dirt. And I would see a slug or, you know, a snail. And slugs are not attractive creatures. And I remember saying to my mother, you know, you've got to kill that. It's disgusting. You kill it. And she would look at me and she said, you have a right to kill that. It has every right to live on this planet. It serves a purpose. It takes up, you know, just because you don't like the way something looks doesn't mean you have the right to deny its existence. And I think that simple little lesson from a toddler, you know, through an adult, to have a parent that teaches you that, is beyond, you know, profound and deep. And you learn, you know, you learn how to treat people very, very differently. And I wish we would all have learned these lessons.
Well, that's interesting because there's a huge, and the correct way to think of these things is to lean into our differences, is to greet each other by stating our differences, whether including our sexual proclivities. What am I trying to say? Like, I am a cisgendered white woman. That is my identity. And this is something that, as you say, she fought against. You have a quote from her, Eartha saying, "I'm not black and I'm not white and I'm not pink and I'm not green. Eartha Kitt has no color, and that is how barriers are broken." You also wrote to this, and I found this interesting, one of the sources of why you wanted to write this. You said that with the rise of Black Lives Matter, that you were getting attacked openly almost every day. And then you wrote, "It amazes me that because I don't look the way many think I should look, they question my identity. On the one hand, I hesitate to dignify them with an answer. On the other, though, I think we need to keep that conversation going, because the stereotypes of how we think each other should look are continuing to the rifts within society, the anger and the battles we are experiencing right now." So you are primarily getting on the receiving end of saying you can't possibly be sympathetic to a Black Lives Matter movement because you are not Black or do not look Black or do not pass for Black.
Right. I mean, I think that, I can't help the way that I was born. I literally have no control over how I was born. Right. I mean, I agree. I mean, there's a certain amount of, you know, I can empathize, but I was, you know, I also happen to have been born to a famous person. So, I mean, those are pieces that are facts, but to say that I am not my mother's daughter because I don't look, you know, like her. I don't look like her. I'm not dark enough. I couldn't possibly be her biological child. I think it's just the ignorance in that, the lack of ability to understand that, you know, genetics are funky and weird, and I can't help the way that I came out. It's just the way that I did. I just think it just keeps us stuck. There are people who want to stay stuck. They want to stay stuck in a mindset. And there's so many, I mean, look, there's so many problems that we need to address, and there's so many issues, and the mistreatment and the inequality of fairness is beyond. I totally understand that. But I think this desire to keep focused on that, you know, people should be treated differently because they have the color of their skin, is something that I just wish we would just all kind of let go of. I mean, there's so many other important things that we need to change, I think.
Right. When she, I mean, you then spent your life growing up with her, as you say, going everywhere with her, then you became her manager up until she died in 2008. It was very moving, the description of her death, and you were with her, of course, and she let out a great howl that did not go easily or gently. But, and then what you said about losing a mother, I mean, I always think of a mother as like the sun in a child's universe, you know, they're just good or bad, they're there, they're constant. You're mm-hmm. like a planet orbiting them. But then you lose, the sun goes out of your life. In this case, it was a very big sun. You'd given your life over to professional life, to her career. Talk about how you've coped with that loss since, and maybe how you have changed or grown into being Kitt and not part of Eartha, you know?
That's a really good how you've grown into being Kit and not part of Eartha, because I do think that that's a really hard thing to grapple with. You put your wrap your mind around. I think death is so difficult to understand. As I talk in the book, and the reason I talk about it is because it's keeping these conversations open. I mean, none of us are getting out of here. We're not escaping that one. You know, we're all going to die at some point. As horrible as it is, as sad as it might be. I don't want to say horrible, as sad as it is. I talk about losing her because I talk about how hard it was to understand that, you know, I literally was sitting there and in one split second, there was this person, you know, this body, this vessel that possessed this person. And in the next minute, the vessel was still there, but that human being, that person that I knew, was gone. And that desire as a human to sort of understand that, you know, that where is that person? I totally understood why heaven is such a, you know, tangible place. You know, people yearn for it to be a tangible place because you want to believe that human being that you loved, or maybe you didn't love, and you don't want them to go to heaven. You want them to go someplace else, but you want them to be someplace. You want them to physically be present, their spirit to be someplace. And so for a very long time, you know, I would sort of look up into the sky and I would say, you know, where are you? Where did you go? You didn't just poof, disappear. You couldn't have. All of that spirit, that human being that you were, couldn't have just vanished into midair, you know, into the ether. So I think this coming to terms with, you know, like you just said, you know, sort of losing the sun, is that what happens to me now? Like, who do I be? Who am I? Who do I become? I was, you know, I carry her name. I was like her, you know, her second banana. I was like the Ed McMahon to her, you know, Johnny Carson. You know, who am I now without her? I think that, you know, there's a lot of like, inversion, you know, interpersonal, you know, thinking that you do when you've lost somebody. There's so much grief is so just, you know, the evolution of grief is interesting. So I think, you know, I've become more of an outspoken than I ever thought I would be. I certainly let her do that when she was alive. I was sort of the, you know, she'll do the talking. I'll just sit over here and I'll do other things. You know, I do the business piece of it. I've become more, I think more courageous in some ways. I've become more self-aware and self-confident, but it's taken time. I mean, she's gone. It's now, you know, it's 2008 that she died. Those first couple of years, I was just a complete, you know, numb and, you know, I didn't know where I would have put myself. The first few Mother's Days were really, really difficult. Not being, you know, not having a mother anymore was really, really hard on Mother's Day, especially, even though it's a Hallmark holiday. But, you know, I think that it's a very interesting, I am very lucky that, you know, I had a mother who was so powerful and so impactful, and that I've been able to sort of take on some of that strength that she maybe left behind, that she instilled in me, these lessons that she taught me that I talk about in the book. The way that she parented was so, you know, potent and impactful and powerful. And so my ability now to share who she was with the world is my way. As she would say to me, you know, a lot of her life, you know, when I die, you know, don't let who I was die with me. You know, my performances, my, you know, music, that will live on in perpetuity. But who I was as a human being, it's for you to now, you know, take the reins and to now, you know, take that legacy and make it your own. And I think that's, you know, that's so true. And I do it. My mother happened to be famous, so it seems like that's an important thing to do, but I think we all have a legacy. You know, we all have a parent or a person in our lives who maybe we lose and who's impacted us in some way, positive or negative, that we then, you know, it's important to share the history, to keep, you know, to keep these stories, to keep those words alive for the generations that come after.
And you also managed to do something that she never managed to do, which is have a husband and children and seemingly happy marriage. How did you pull that off, given that you had really no example of it in your life at all?
Yeah, I think as an only child with a single parent, I think I yearned, obviously. I didn't want to have only one child. It's a lot of responsibility to be an only child. But then, of course, I know, you know, as my kids will say, you know, sometimes they wish they were only children. So, I mean, we always want what we don't have. I think that I saw, you know, my mother was by herself a lot. And as she got older, I think it wasn't easy for her. There were times it wasn't easy for me. I was her caregiver. I was her companion in many situations. I mean, luckily she lived very close by always. So we weren't ever very far apart. I think relationships are very, very tricky, obviously. I don't think marriage or families are easy. There are always different personalities coming to the table. But, I think we all do the best we can. And I think my mother did the best she could.
Right. And you saw that, well, compromise doesn't have to be always a bad thing.
Right. I mean, that is, we go back to that quote of hers where she said, you know, I'm not going to compromise for a man. And I understand where she was coming from. She's not going to change who she is. But I do think when you're in relationships, there is, you know, there is a lot of compromise. My husband will probably say he makes more compromises than I do. But, you know, I think there's always one person who compromises more. So there are ways, you know, there are things about my mother that, you know, obviously I didn't want to emulate. And, you know, having a relationship, a long-term one, was one that, you know, was important to me.
Well, it's really such a good book, such an interesting story. I just love thinking about Eartha Kitt again. I went on YouTube, I watched her sing, and it was really, really wonderful. So the book again is Eartha and Kitt, A Daughter's Love Story in Black and White. Kitt, thank you so much for coming on and spending this time and telling us about your mom.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really do appreciate it.
Right. Well, that's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. The Femsplainers is a weekly podcast carried on the Podcast One Network. Nat Frum produces and edits our audio and video. You can follow us on Twitter and FB at Femsplainers. And on Instagram at Femsplainers Podcast. We love hearing from you. You can reach out to us via email at contact@femsplainers.com. You'll find all our episodes and more information about me and the podcast at femsplainers.com. And remember, we rely on your donations to keep this podcast going. So please consider supporting us at patreon.com/femsplainers.